Canada looks to USA for drug policy hints. The Vancouver Sun reported that conservative cabinet ministers and their aides are consulting keen U.S. federal officials on a new national drug strategy, according to documents obtained by the paper. Neil Boyd, a criminologist at Simon Fraser University, commented that the Harper government favors a U.S.-style approach to drug problems, which is to lock more people up. Rather than recognizing addiction as a health issue, said Dr. Boyd, this view sees it as a criminal law problem of morality. That's very much at odds with what's going on in Europe, and there's really no good evidence to suggest that it's going to be terribly useful. The restrained and understated words of a carefully spoken academic. In Washington State, the King County Bar Association has acknowledged the devastation caused by prevailing drug policies. In 2001, it adopted a comprehensive statement asserting that the war on drugs is fundamentally flawed and is associated with numerous negative societal consequences. Their summary of the war's disastrous effects reflects the consensus view of virtually all those in North America and elsewhere who have studied the question without ideological blinkers. The failure to reduce problematic drug use, particularly among children. Dramatic increases in crime related to prohibited drugs, including economic crimes related to addiction, and the fostering of efficient and violent criminal enterprises that have occupied the unregulated and immensely profitable commercial market made possible by drug prohibition. Skyrocketing public costs arising from both increased drug abuse and increased crime. Erosion of public health from the spread of disease, from the concealment and inadequate treatment of addiction, and from undue restrictions on proper medical treatment of pain. The abridgment of civil rights through summary forfeitures of property, invasions of privacy, and violations of due process. Disproportionately adverse effects of drug law enforcement on the poor and persons of color, and the clogging of the courts and compromises in the effective administration of justice, as well as a loss of respect for the law. The war on drugs fails and is doomed to perpetual failure because it is directed not against the root causes of drug addiction and of the international black market in drugs, but only against some drug producers, traffickers, and users. More fundamentally, the war is doomed because neither the methods of war nor the war metaphor itself is appropriate to a complex social problem that calls for compassion, self-searching insight, and factually researched scientific understanding. The pertinent question is not why the war on drugs is being lost, but why it continues to be waged in the face of all the evidence against it. Chapter 26. Freedom of Choice and the Choice of Freedom. A core assumption in the war on drugs is that the addict is free to make the choice not to be addicted, and that harsh social or legal measures will deter him from pursuing his habit. It is not that easy. Contrary to Nancy Reagan's simplistic billboard messages, people cannot just say no in the face of addictive drives. One arena in which freedom of choice operates is the social world, the world of interactions, opportunities, and relationships. Another is the inner realm of the psyche. In the first arena, which is shaped by our materialistic culture, it is futile to pretend that we all have equal freedom. Just ask the hardcore drug user, acutely aware of his position at the very bottom of the social hierarchy. Steve, a 40-year-old addict, has spent 18 years of his adult life in prison. As he sat in my office one morning recently, he was staring out the window or at the wall or the ceiling. Anything but looking at me directly. He's angry, and he's afraid of his anger. Bitterness pours from his heart, first about being obliged to drink methadone every day under a pharmacist's supervision, and then about many other features of his existence that he sees as being under the control of one authority or another, doctor, druggist, hotel staff, social worker. His frustration is not new. A sense of injustice colors the narrative of his entire life.
Freedom comes with a dollar sign attached, he says. The poor sap who collects a welfare check to keep him from sleeping in the street gets walked all over. He has no freedom. I'm always being told what to do. It's like being back in jail. The only difference is that now and then, I can get some pussy. For all his self-pity, there is also truth in Steve's perception. Freedom in society is gauged by our success in getting what we want, and conditioned by status and power, by race, class, and gender. In the internal world of the psyche, however, freedom means something very different. It is the ability to opt for our long-term physical and spiritual well-being as opposed to our immediate urges. Absent that ability, any talk of free will or choice becomes nearly meaningless. We recall Thomas De Quincey's reference to his opium habit as the chain of abject slavery. The chains of addiction are internal and invisible. They fetter the mind first, the body second. We have seen that the addiction process commandeers powerful brain circuits and bends their activity towards maladaptive behaviors. We have also seen that in the addicted brain, the rational, impulse-regulating parts of the cortex are poorly developed even before the addiction takes hold, and they are further damaged by drug use. Thus, the dilemma of freedom in addiction may be phrased this way. A person driven largely by unconscious forces and automatic brain mechanisms is only poorly able to exercise any meaningful freedom of choice. A great deal of study has been devoted to the freedom of choice issue in the case of obsessive-compulsive disorder, OCD, a condition that has important features in common with addiction. We can learn a lot about psychic freedom from this research. Dr. Jeffrey Schwartz, professor of psychiatry at the UCLA School of Medicine, has devoted decades to studying OCD and has described his findings in two fascinating books. In OCD, certain circuits of the brain do not work normally. Several parts seem locked together, just as if a car's transmission was stuck so that turning on the engine automatically set the wheels into motion. In OCD, the neurological gears that would uncouple the engine of thought from the wheels of action are stuck. Completely irrational thoughts or beliefs trigger repeated behaviors that are useless and even harmful. The obsessive-compulsive person is intellectually aware that his impulse to, say, wash his hands for the 100th time lacks reason, but he cannot stop himself. Owing to his stuck neurological clutch, the idea of having to cleanse himself yet again leads automatically to hand washing. Dr. Schwartz and his colleagues at UCLA have demonstrated the mechanisms of this brain lock, as he has called it, on brain scans. OCD may be an extreme example of how the brain can dictate behavior even against our will, but OCD sufferers are different from other people only in degree. Much of what we do arises from automatic programming that bypasses conscious awareness and may even run contrary to our intentions, as Dr. Schwartz points out. The passive side of mental life, which is generated solely and completely by brain mechanisms, dominates the tone and tenor of our day-to-day, even our second-to-second experience. During the quotidian business of daily life, the brain does indeed operate very much as a machine does. Decisions that we may believe to be freely made can arise from unconscious emotional drives or subliminal beliefs. They can be dictated by brain mechanisms programmed early in childhood and determined by events of which we have no recollection. The stronger a person's automatic brain mechanisms and the weaker the parts of the brain that can impose conscious control, the less true freedom that person will be able to exercise in her life. In OCD, and in many other conditions, no matter how intelligent and well-meaning the individual, the malfunctioning brain circuitry may override rational judgment and intention. Almost any human being, when overwhelmed by stress or powerful emotions, will act or react not from intention, but from mechanisms that are set off deep in the brain, rather than being generated in the conscious and volitional segments of the cortex. When acting from a driven or triggered state, we are not free. I interviewed Dr. Schwartz by telephone late one Friday evening, a discussion on addiction that might have made an outside observer roll his eyes, Two Nighthawk workaholic physicians talking shop, a classic case of it takes one to know one. When you get right down to the nuts and bolts of understanding what the brain is doing and the relationship between conscious experience and the brain, Dr. Schwartz said, the data does not support the commonly held principle that you can just will yourself into one mental state or another. It's a subtle thing, Freedom. It takes effort. It takes attention and focus not to act something like an automaton. Although we do have freedom, we exercise it only when we strive for awareness, when we are conscious not just of the content of the mind, but also of the mind itself as a process. When not governed by conscious awareness, our mind tends to run on automatic pilot. It is scarcely more free than a computer that performs pre-programmed tasks in response to a button being pushed. The distinction between automatic mechanism and conscious free will may be illustrated by the difference between punching a wall with your fist in a fit of reactive rage and mindfully saying to yourself, I have so much anger in me, I really want to punch this wall right now. Or even more consciously, my mind tells me I should punch this wall. The latter mind states give you the option of not striking the wall, without which there is no choice and no freedom, just a fractured hand and a head full of regret. Choice implies consciousness, Eckhart Tolle points out, a high degree of consciousness. Without it, you have no choice. We may say then that in the world of the psyche, freedom is a relative concept. The power to choose exists only when our automatic mental mechanisms are subject to those brain systems that are able to maintain conscious awareness. A person experiences greater or less freedom from one situation to the next, from one interaction to the next, from one moment to the next. Anyone whose automatic brain mechanisms habitually run in overdrive has diminished capacity for free decision-making, especially if the parts of the brain that facilitate conscious choice are impaired or underdeveloped. We have said that addiction itself is a continuum, at one end of which lives the intravenous user hopelessly hooked to his habit. Most humans exist somewhere on that line between enslavement to destructive habits at one end and total consciousness and non-attachment at the other. In exactly the same way, freedom of choice can be represented as a continuum. Realistically, very few people could ever be found operating at the positive extreme, truly conscious and consistently free. In the mind world of the psyche, as in the material world, some people have more freedom than others. It would be absurd to assert, for example, that in practically worldly matters such as choosing domicile or food, a street dweller has the same degree of freedom as, say, a Wall Street tycoon. On the other hand, in the realm of emotional freedom and conscious decision-making, a penniless hermit may enjoy much more latitude than a status-addicted millionaire who, still compensating for unconscious childhood hurts, is driven by an insatiable need to be feared or admired. The hardcore drug addict finds the worst of both worlds. Low on the totem pole of psychological freedom, she is also at the base of the socioeconomic ladder. The rest of us perch more or less precariously, at whatever altitude, somewhere above her. In many respects, the addict has as little freedom as the person with OCD. Once the impulse to use a substance arises, brain lock occurs. My patients tell me over and over again that they simply cannot resist the crack pipe or the speedball or the fix of heroin when it's offered to them or when they know it's available. A speedball is a combination of heroin and cocaine prepared for injection. Neither can they refrain from using when they feel stressed or upset or lonely or restless or bored or excited. Even I, without any history of substance dependence, have immense difficulty resisting the mental pressure I experience when the urge to buy CDs begins to churn in my mind. Though I make resolution after resolution, promise after promise, in the end it seems easier just to give in, to get the struggle over with, to relieve the mental tension by running to Sikora's and handing over my money to the ruthless music traffickers who lurk there among the stacks of recordings. Although I know full well that I have a say in the matter, it often feels like I'm powerless. And if I can feel that powerless, a middle-class professional in middle age with a loving family and a life that mostly I love, How free are my Portland hotel patients? Once more, freedom is relative. I believe I have much more freedom than the hardcore drug users. Both the obsessive compulsive and the addict experience overwhelming tension until they succumb to their compulsive drive. When they finally do, they gain an immense, if momentary, sense of relief. Given this absence of psychic freedom, the addict might as well be an obsessive compulsive, with one essential difference. Unlike the addict, the person with OCD does not anticipate his compulsive activity with any pleasure. Far from craving it, as the addict does, he regards it as unpleasant and distressing. It may seem at first glance that the addict is more culpable, since he enjoys his behavior as compared with the OCD patient who suffers from it. In reality, the addict's temporary enjoyment makes it all the more difficult for him to give up his habit, whereas the obsessive compulsive would be only too glad to do so, if shown how. When it comes to choosing recovery, this momentary but highly enticing pleasure experience puts the addict at a disadvantage, even if what we call pleasure is, in addiction, little more than an evanescent sense of relief from mental distress or spiritual emptiness. Of course, many addicts with forbidding childhood histories and prolonged self-destructive chemical or behavioral habits have recovered and recreated themselves as conscious, effective, and compassionate members of society. Their transformation is proof that we can never write off anyone as beyond the possibility of freedom. But in practice, we are in no position to demand that all addicts should make that choice. It is useful to study and consider what combination of self-knowledge, strength, supportive environment, good fortune, and pure grace allows some people to escape the death grip of hardcore addiction. It is not helpful, however, to compare any one person with another. Just because one person succeeds doesn't mean that we're entitled to judge another for having failed. For all our similarities, from the moment of conception, we are each shaped by our own unique makeup and set of life experiences. No two human brains look alike, not even those of identical twins. One person's pain cannot be compared with anyone else's, nor can we compare any two people's capacity to endure suffering. In addition to the visible factors, there are also many subtle, invisible ones that may positively influence our psychic strength and our capacity for choice. A kind word spoken long ago, a fortuitous circumstance, a new relationship, a flash of insight, a memory of love, a sudden opening to faith. People who have overcome severe addictions deserve to be celebrated, and they have much to teach, but their example cannot be used to condemn others who have not been able to follow in their footsteps. It's even more nonsensical to judge addicts by arbitrary criteria derived from the experience of people with relatively normal lives. If it is irrational and hypocritical to hold a minor to the same standard of behavioral control as a mature adult, it is equally unjust to hold a traumatized and neurologically impaired adult to the same standard as one not so afflicted, says brain researcher Martin Teicher. How much actual freedom to choose does any one human being possess? There's only one answer. We cannot know. We may have our particular beliefs, spiritual or otherwise, about this aspect of human nature, about how it is or how it should be. These beliefs may strengthen our commitment to helping others find freedom, or they may become harmful dogma. Either way, in the end, we all have to humble ourselves and admit to a degree of uncertainty. There is no way we can peer into a brain to measure a person's capacity for awareness and rational choice, or to estimate how the relative balance of these brain-mind systems will operate when that person is stressed. There is no gauging the burden of emotional suffering weighing down one person's psyche against another's, and there is no way to know what hidden, life-enhancing experiences one person may have enjoyed that another has been denied. That's why it's facile to demand that anyone should be able to just say no, and to judge them as morally lacking if they can't. Freedom of choice, understood from the perspective of brain development, is not a universal or fixed attribute, but a statistical probability. In other words, given a certain set of life experiences, a human being will have either lesser or greater probability of having freedom in the realm of the psyche. A warmly nurtured child is much more likely to develop emotional freedom than an abused and neglected child. The brain forces us to become reflections of our personal histories, write two U.S. research psychiatrists. Simply stated, children reflect the world in which they are raised. As we have seen, the in utero and early childhood experiences of hardcore addicts will likely diminish the possibility of freedom. The probability of these children attaining even a basic level of psychic freedom from automatic mechanisms and drives is correspondingly less, not completely absent, but less. If we cherish the human potential for transformation, the real issue becomes how to encourage and support the addict's motivation and capacity to choose freedom, despite damaging beginnings and a lifelong history of painful events. How, in other words, to promote healthy brain development later in life when the conditions for it have been lacking from earliest childhood onward. We'll first look at how the experience of choice arises in the brain, and in particular, in the addicted brain. In chapter 16, I pointed out that the role of the cortex, the brain's executive part, is more to inhibit than to initiate. Impulses to act are generated in lower brain systems, but the job of the cortex is to censor some and permit others. As a prominent researcher expressed it, it's not a matter of free will, but of free won't. How much time elapses between impulse and action? Electrical studies of brain function show that it's about half a second. For most of that time, we are not aware of what our brain is proposing to do. In other words, there is a lag period between the impulse arising as a physical signal in the brain and our becoming aware of it as a conscious urge. In a well-functioning cortex, the interval between awareness of the impulse and the activation of the muscles that will carry out the impulse is only 1/10 to 1/5 of a second. Amazingly, it's only in this briefest of intervals that the cortex can suppress behavior it judges to be inappropriate. That's the gap where, for example, we can stop ourselves from raising our hand in anger or saying something hurtful. In that sliver of time, we see ourselves about to perform the act, and if necessary, we can stand between ourselves and the behavior in question. Many people have watched themselves helplessly as they began to do something they knew would be unhelpful or self-defeating. That's the experience of brain lock. The clutch is stuck, so nothing can be done to stop the motor of doing from engaging. A failure of the brain to go into neutral may occur in any human being who is under physical strain, such as fatigue or hunger, or when they are emotionally stressed. In the brain of the addict, the problem is worsened, because her neurological circuits are impaired even under ordinary circumstances. This can be explained by what happens in the split second before the impulse emerges into awareness. In that fraction of a moment, which is still longer than the splinter of time devoted to conscious choice, when we can decide not to do something inappropriate, the brain carries out what is called preattentive analysis. Preattentive analysis is the unconscious evaluation of what goals the brain circuits judge to be essential or irrelevant, valuable or worthless, desirable or unwanted. The cortex is primed to select actions that will achieve the goals set by this preattentive process. And what is the brain of the addict likely to value? Recall that the brain is in large part the product of early influences, and that the attachment reward and incentive motivation systems of the addicted brain were directed toward maladaptive habits when the child's needs for emotional nourishment were frustrated and denied. In the words of the seminal researcher Jak Panseb, drug addictions wouldn't occur unless they were related to natural reward processes of some kind. Habits and the brain circuits that maintain them form around substances and behaviors that promise instant, if only temporary, satisfaction. Those habit structures are so incredibly robust, and once they form in the nervous system, they will guide behavior without free choice, Dr. Panseb said in a personal interview. Addicts become addicts because they develop these habit structures, which become totally focused on non-traditional rewards, drug rewards. They get hooked, and they can't break out of that psychological imprisonment. Thus, the addict comes to make his choice with a brain that overvalues the addictive substance or behavior and undervalues the healthy alternatives. Impulses favoring the addiction process arise. The cortex, whose job it is to censor inappropriate actions, to exercise the free won't, is hobbled. Brain lock sets in. The milliseconds that afford the possibility of just saying no flash by. The whole decision-making process is, it's not even really a process, a patient told one of my colleagues, an addiction physician in the downtown East Side. You just decide to use. There is not a whole lot of thought going on there. You don't really weigh the pros and cons. It's too overwhelming, right? You simply do it, with total disregard for anything else. As I write this chapter, on October 29th, 2006, I'm paged from Vancouver Hospital. A patient of mine, whom I'll call Terence, has been discharged involuntarily. He broke the contract, his nurse informs me in an apologetic tone. Terence is a 32-year-old heroin and cocaine addict with multiple medical problems, including HIV. I have known him for a few months. In speaking with him, one feels that every request is a manipulation, every word hides an agenda, and every interaction serves some ulterior motive. I doubt he is aware of how he appears to others. To borrow from Nietzsche, he lies his way out of reality because he has been hurt by reality. The manipulation and dishonesty have been his automatic defenses since childhood. He must be terrified that without them, he will suffer deprivation. Admitted to a medical ward last week for an infectious illness, 2 days later he was arrested at a nearby supermarket for shoplifting. The police took him back to hospital, where he signed an undertaking not to leave the unit and not to engage in any illegal behavior. Today, he stole a nurse's jacket, wallet, and keys and disappeared for several hours. The jacket was retrieved. The money and keys were gone. The hospital saw no alternative but to discharge him, despite the fact that his infection had not been completely eradicated. Terence's behavior patterns do not change, regardless of the disastrous consequences. Over the years, he has alienated every caregiver who has worked with him, has repeatedly sabotaged his medical treatment and his health, and has ensured that no facility in Vancouver other than the Portland Hotel will even consider having him as a resident. If we could peer into his brain at the moment he was about to lift the nurse's jacket from the ward office, I doubt we would see much activity in the segments that control impulse and generate conscious will. More likely, the dopamine circuits of incentive, excitement, and thrill would predominate. It's less a conscious decision to steal that led to Terence's expulsion from hospital than an inability not to, given the opportunity. No powerful free won't operates in his brain. Later, he'll be filled with regret, but at the next opportunity will reenact exactly the same scenario. How much freedom does he really have? The overvaluing of the addictive object, act, relationship, or behavior exists in all addictions, as does the brain lock phenomenon. In the substance addict, it is fortified, as we have seen, by the effect of the drugs themselves on the brain. Drugs damage the parts of the brain, already impaired to begin with, that exercise conscious will. In a passage I partially quoted in Chapter 14, Dr. Nora Volkow, director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse in the U.S., has written, "This aberrant behavior has traditionally been viewed as bad choices that are made voluntarily by the addict. However, recent studies have shown that repeated drug use leads to long-lasting changes in the brain that undermine voluntary control. The men and women I work with have had every possible negative consequence visited upon them. They have lost their jobs, their homes, their spouses, their children, and their teeth. They have been jailed and beaten, abused and raped. They have suffered HIV infection and hepatitis and infections of the heart valves and of the backbone. They have had multiple pneumonias and abscesses and sores of every sort. They have seen close friends die young of overdose or disease. They are far from naive about the seriousness of the matter, and require no more convincing or coercing, and yet they will not, unless something transforms their perspective on life, abandon their compulsion to use drugs. We, as a society, cannot respond to their predicament with unenforceable laws, moral preaching, and medical practices that do not employ the full range of possible options. How, then, to create the circumstances in which the possibility of freedom can take root and flourish? That's the subject we turn to next.
Chapter 27. Toward an Enlightened Social Policy on Drugs.
I'll start from the assumption that we want to redeem people trapped in drug addiction. And that redemption can be something other than an addict's complete abstinence from addictive chemicals, a goal that's not always realistic. Under current conditions, it hardly ever is for most hardcore substance users, although I believe our success rate could be much higher if we abandoned our present intolerant and self-defeating social attitudes toward addiction and the care of addicted people. Even in cases where abstinence is not achieved, redemption would mean the reintegration of the user into the larger community and the restoration of his value as a person in his own eyes. In the next pages, I'll outline what I believe would be a rational and humane stance toward drug users, along with the policies that would flow from it. I do not expect such ideas to be embraced by society anytime soon. An informed approach may be, for now, no more than a dream. In a culture that projects its darkest features onto the addict and makes addicted people into scapegoats for its shortcomings, insight and knowledge are almost entirely absent from public discourse concerning drug policies. Moralizing displaces compassion, and prejudice substitutes for inquiry. The evidence accumulated by decades of scientific research into the psychology of addiction, brain development, child rearing, and the social origins of addictive drives rarely enters into the discussion of how to tackle the persisting problem of drug addiction. Indeed, as this book goes to press, the Globe and Mail reports that Canada's assault on drug addicts is about to escalate. According to the Globe, the federal Conservative government is preparing to unveil a strategy that cracks down on illicit drug users, with harsher penalties for users of illicit substances. The mountain of evidence showing the worthlessness of this get-tough approach is once more ignored. The scarcity of scientific thought informing public debates on addiction is mirrored in the academic and medical arenas. In this era of sub-sub-specialization, each discipline appears to work in isolation from knowledge gathered by other researchers in closely related fields. We need far more integration of knowledge, both in the professional realm and among lay people. Why does medical practice appear to be so opaque to the light of new findings? I've thought about this a lot, child psychiatrist and researcher Dr. Bruce Perry said when I interviewed him, because I've been involved in several public education campaigns. What we found is that the groups that have the greatest vested interest in the old beliefs are the last to absorb new content. As such, medicine has been the most resistant professional group to absorb and integrate the emerging findings about brain development and the importance of early childhood. I don't believe that the vested interests of medical professionals are, in this case, consciously selfish or motivated by material considerations. They are the investment we have in maintaining that our way of thinking is right, that the principles and methods we have practiced are sound, and that approaches outside our emotional or intellectual comfort zones are not worth investigating. Institutions such as professional bodies, medical schools, and scientific associations tend to be deeply conservative, even if in some ways they are at the forefront of bold exploration. They mistrust new paradigms and resist moving outside the boundaries of a narrowly defined science ideology that separates mind from body, human beings from their lifetime environments. Similarly, most political leaders and policymakers seem unaware of the abundance of facts and experience refuting the theory and practices of the war on drugs, or they lack the will to act on the evidence. In the worst-case scenario, some may be too blinded by a moralistic and judgment-ridden ideology to act according to the Christian principles they profess. Hence the need to imagine a humane reality that we could create if we chose to honor what science, insight, and the precepts of our ethical and spiritual traditions teach us. The current set of public beliefs and institutional beliefs about substance abuse are impediments to the application of high-quality, successful intervention, says Dr. Perry. The more we dehumanize and vilify substance abusers, the more it is impossible to put in place the kind of interventions that will help them. In other words, we need to get outside the box. The system we have doesn't work, not for the addict and not for society. This system cannot be improved. It needs to be transformed. I don't claim that what I will propose is without potential pitfalls, or that I could possibly have got all the details right. But for this discussion, the details are not the issue. The issue is the relationship society creates between itself and its drug-addicted citizens. The fundamental question is whether or not we recognize these people as human beings who are legitimately part of the social fabric, deserving compassion and respect. Action has meaning only in relationship, said the spiritual teacher Jiddu Krishnamurti. And without understanding relationship, action on any level will only breed conflict. The understanding of relationship is infinitely more important than the search for any plan of action. It's not the particulars of a social policy that matter most, but the relationship between those who influence policy and those who are affected by it. People may well disagree with what is suggested in this chapter, but we cannot afford to ignore Krishnamurti's teaching on the precedence of relationship over action. First, we need to take stock of ourselves and give up any hint of moral superiority and judgment toward the addict. Judging others clouds our eyes not only to their needs, but to our own as well. Going back to the words of Jesus, "First take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the splinter out of your brother's eye." We cannot help people when we put ourselves in a position of judgment. Addicts, all but the very few completely sociopathic ones, are deeply self-critical and harsh with themselves. They are keenly sensitive to judgmental tones in others and respond with withdrawal or defensive denial. Second, any rational approach to the problem of addiction has to be grounded in an appreciation of the interactive psychology and brain physiology of addiction. An understanding of emotions should not be separated from neuroscience, Dr. Yakpan Sep told me. If you don't recognize that the brain creates psychological responses, then neuroscience becomes a highly impoverished discipline. And that's where the battle is right now. Many neuroscientists believe that mental states are irrelevant for what the brain does. This is a Galileo-type battle, and it will not be won very easily because you have generations and generations of scholars, even in psychology, who have swallowed hook, line, and sinker the notion, this Skinnerian notion, that mentality is irrelevant in the control of behavior. Skinnerian refers to B.F. Skinner of Indiana University, considered the founder of the hugely influential behaviorist school of psychology, which focuses only on behaviors, excluding invisible factors like emotions from its analysis of human conduct and relationships. Dr. Pangsep is not tilting at windmills. Narrow behaviorist thinking permeates political and social policy and medical practice, the child-rearing advice dispensed by parenting experts, and academic discourse. We keep trying to change people's behaviors without a full understanding of how and why those behaviors arise. Inner causes are not the proper domain of psychology, writes Roy Wise, an expert on the psychology of addiction and a prominent investigator in the National Institute on Drug Abuse in the USA. This statement seems astonishing coming from a psychologist. In reality, there can be no understanding of human beings, let alone of addicted human beings, without looking at inner causes, tricky as those causes can be to pin down at times. Behaviors, especially compulsive behaviors, are often the active representations of emotional states and of special kinds of brain functioning. As we have seen, the dominant emotional states and the brain patterns of human beings are shaped by their early environment. Throughout their lifetimes, they are in dynamic interaction with various social and emotional milieus. If we are to help addicts, we must strive to change not them, but their environments. These are the only things we can change. Transformation of the addict must come from within, and the best we can do is to encourage it. Fortunately, there is much that we can do. In the previous chapter, I presented evidence that addictive habits, generally speaking, are too deeply entrenched in the brain of the hardcore substance user to be overcome by a simple act of will. As Jack Panset put it, those habit structures are so incredibly robust, and once they are laid into a nervous system, they will guide behavior without free choice. My discussion with Professor Panksepp did not end there. We went on to consider what support addicts would need to overcome the powerful drives imprinted by their painful experiences. The only way they can escape drug addictions is if their pain is alleviated, their emotions are brought back towards healthy balance, so they have a chance to think about it, Dr. Panksepp said, echoing both what brain research has told us about mental freedom and what human experience has confirmed. Free choice only comes from thinking. It doesn't come from emotions. It emerges from the capacity to think about your emotions. When you're operating in the habit mode, you are feeling, but those feelings are not being reflected upon. They are too powerful. They are too habitual. So the treatment of addiction requires the island of relief where a need to soothe pain does not constantly drive a person's motivation. It requires a complex and supportive social environment. How to create that island of relief is the core issue in projecting a humane policy toward addiction. The work of the Portland Hotel Society is an isolated, flawed, but worthy attempt at offering the respite from anguish and anxiety that Dr. Panksepp suggests. Although the PHS has grown from an initial grant of $23,000 back in 1991 to a current annual operating budget of over $11 million, most of it for housing, the services it can provide are no more than a drop in the bucket compared with the needs of the community it serves in the downtown East Side. Addicts are locked into addiction not only by their painful past and distressing present, but equally by their bleak view of the future. They cannot envision the real possibility of sobriety, of a life governed by values rather than by immediate survival needs and by desperation to escape physical and mental suffering. They are unable to develop compassion toward themselves and their bodies while they are regarded as outcasts, hunted as enemies, and treated like human refuse. As we have seen, a major factor in addiction that medical and social policies must take into account is stress. If we want to support people's potential for healthy transformation, we must cease to impose debilitating stress on their already burdened existence. Recall that uncertainty, isolation, loss of control, and conflict are the major triggers for stress, and that stress is the most predictable factor in maintaining addiction and triggering relapse. These are also precisely the conditions that the demonization of addiction and the war on drugs deliberately impose on hardcore substance users. I have quoted a report in the Journal of the American Medical Association which showed that a history of childhood abuse increases physiological stress reactivity for a lifetime, a reactivity which is further enhanced when additional trauma is experienced in adulthood. The addict is re-traumatized over and over again by ostracism, harassment, dire poverty, the spread of disease, the frantic hunt for a source of the substance of dependence, the violence of the underground drug world, and harsh chastisement at the hands of the law, all inevitable consequences of the war on drugs. Studies on primates and other animals have also shown that low social status and being dominated enhance the risk of drug use with negative effects on dopamine receptors. By contrast, after being housed with more subordinate animals, dominant monkeys had an increase of over 20% of their dopamine receptors and less tendency to use cocaine. The findings of stress research suggest that the issue is not control over others, but whether one is free to exercise control in one's own life. Yet the practices of the social welfare, legal, and medical systems subject the addict to domination in many ways and deprive her of control, even if unwittingly. In relegating the addict to the bottom of the social and moral scales, and in our contemptuous rejection of her as a person, we have created the exact circumstances that are most likely to keep her trapped in pathological dependence on drugs. There is no island of relief, only oceanic despair. The war on drugs is cultural schizophrenia, says Jack Pansep. I agree. The war on drugs expresses a split mindset in two ways. We want to eradicate or limit addiction, yet our social policies are best suited to promote it. And we condemn the addict for qualities we dare not acknowledge in ourselves. Rather than exhort the addict to be other than the way she is, we need to find the strength to admit that we have greatly exacerbated her distress, and perhaps our own. If we want to help people seek the possibility of transformation within themselves, we first have to transform our own view of our relationship to them. That our current approach is a dead end has been acknowledged in Canada, in the U.S., and internationally by many people whose political and ideological starting point was not anywhere close to embracing the decriminalization of drugs. Today, November 17, 2006, as I'm writing this chapter, the Globe and Mail reports that the BC Progress Board, a blue ribbon panel made up of business people and academics appointed by the British Columbia government to offer advice on economic and social issues, has proposed that drugs either be decriminalized or that the war on drugs be stepped up so as to completely eliminate the drug trade in this province. One or the other. The status quo is clearly unacceptable if we seek truly to reduce the rates of crime and victimization in the province, the Progress Board stated. The panel warns, in the words of the Globe report, that a crackdown on the drug trade would mean more police, tougher penalties for drug-related crimes, and more jails to accommodate the dramatically increased demand for secure facilities. In effect, the recommendations are a barely camouflaged call for decriminalization. The so-called other option, the elimination of drug trafficking and use, is no option at all. Only a chimera that even the most draconian measures have failed to conjure into reality anywhere in the world. Unless we are willing to see our society metamorphose into a brutal police state, no coercive policy will come close to even limiting drug use, let alone eliminating it. Once we understand that the current assault on addicts creates greater insecurity for everyone and severe hardship for users, once we understand that stressing people chronically and mercilessly can in no way promote their capacity for healthy transformation, it becomes a straightforward matter to envision approaches that rely not on moralizing, but on science and humane values. The indispensable foundation of a rational stance toward drug addiction would be the decriminalization of all substance dependence and the provision of such substances to confirmed users under safely controlled conditions. It's important to note that decriminalization does not mean legalization. Legalization would make manufacturing and selling drugs legal, acceptable commercial activities. Decriminalization refers only to removing from the penal code the possession of drugs for personal use. It would create the possibility of medically supervised dispensing when necessary. The fear that easier access to drugs would fuel addiction is unfounded. Drugs, we have seen, are not the cause of addiction. Despite the fact that cannabis is openly available in Holland, for instance, Dutch per capita use of marijuana is half that in the United States, and no one is advocating the open availability of hard drugs. Decriminalization also does not mean that addicts will be able to walk into any pharmacy to get a prescription of cocaine. Their drugs of dependence should be dispensed under public authority and under medical supervision in pure form, not adulterated by unscrupulous dealers. Addicts also ought to be offered the information, the facilities, and the instruments they need to use drugs as safely as possible. The health benefits of such an approach are self-evident: greatly reduced risk of infection and disease transmission, much less risk of overdose, and very importantly, comfortable and regular access to medical care. Not having to spend exorbitant amounts on drugs that in themselves are inexpensive to prepare, addicts would not be forced into crime, violence, prostitution, or poverty to pay for their habits. They would not have to decide between eating or drug use, or to scrounge for food in garbage cans, or pick cigarette butts out of sidewalk puddles. They would no longer need to suffer malnutrition. I admit I am ambivalent about the decriminalization of certain drugs, particularly crystal meth, and I understand why some people would resist even discussing the possibility. But if it seems bizarre to suggest that such a potentially brain-toxic drug be legally administered to addicts, consider that the street products currently available are full of impurities, mixed with noxious chemicals that magnify the damage from the stimulant itself. By bringing the crystal meth addict into a therapeutic interaction with the healthcare system, we would be fostering the possibility of use and gradual detoxification and withdrawal under relatively safe circumstances. Relatively, because there is no safe way to use crystal meth. Above all, such an approach would create a basis for gently shepherding the addict toward rehabilitation. It would provide an opportunity to create a healing relationship with users who are currently relegated to streets and back alleys. Further, if many users no longer had to turn to illicit drug labs and dealers for their substance, the underground economy of crystal meth would be deprived of much of its profit and allure. Not an ideal situation, but a vast mitigation of the present dismal scenario. And very much to the point, most young people who become hooked on crystal meth are self-medicating for other conditions, most commonly ADHD, but also depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, or the effects of emotional and social dislocation. As we discussed in Chapter 3, some young street people who use crystal meth see it as a way of survival. If the necessary physical, psychological, and social supports were provided, I believe it would not take long to diminish the appeal of methamphetamine and to wean the vast majority of stimulant addicts away from this harmful chemical. Many people fear that decriminalization and the controlled dispensing of drugs will lead to widespread substance use among people who are now deterred from becoming addicts only by existing legal prohibitions. Like other tenets of the war on drugs, this view entirely lacks supporting evidence. Any data on the subject points to the opposite prediction. For example, for many decades in the United Kingdom, heroin has been dispensed under legal supervision to addicts. The same type of program has been offered on a limited basis in other countries as well, and nowhere has it been found that this measure served in any way to entice unaddicted people into addiction. That is not surprising, given that addiction is a response to life experience, not simply to a drug. People who do not suffer the searing emotional pain that drives hardcore drug addiction will rarely fall into dependency on chemicals, even if these were more readily available. And once more, public access to habit-forming substances is not being proposed. The call for the decriminalization of drugs for personal use does not imply legal acceptance of drug dealing. Criminalization and prevention are not identical. If anything, the first undermines the other. Paradoxical though it may seem, current drug laws against possession make drugs more readily available to potential new users than decriminalization would. Only the war on drugs creates the raison d'être of the international trafficking industry, most of whose wealth is based on satisfying the cravings of established drug addicts. Without the exorbitant profits yielded by supplying to addicted users desperate for their substances, the illegal market would shrink to a fragment of its present size. Further, much of the street-level frontline sales force of the illicit drug trade consists of users raising money to support their habit. With the decriminalization of possession for personal use and the medically supervised distribution of drugs, the incentive to sell to new customers, including young kids, would largely evaporate. Policing resources could then be concentrated on the remaining large-scale traffickers, if any. Addicts should not be coerced into treatment, since in the long term, coercion creates more problems than it solves. On the other hand, for those addicts who opt for treatment, there must be a system of publicly funded recovery facilities with clean rooms, nutritious food, and access to outdoors and nature. well-trained professional staff need to provide medical care, counseling, skills training, and emotional support. Our current non-system is utterly inadequate, with its patchwork of recovery homes run on private contracts and here and there, a few upscale addiction treatment spas for the wealthy. No matter how committed their staff and how helpful their services may be, they are a drop in comparison to the ocean of vast need. In the absence of a coordinated rehabilitation system, the efforts of individual recovery homes are limited and occur in a vacuum with no follow-up. It may be thought that the cost of such a drug rehabilitation and treatment system would be exorbitant. No doubt the financial expenses would be great, but surely less than the funds now freely squandered on the war on drugs, to say nothing of the savings from the cessation of drug-related criminal activity and the diminished burden on the healthcare system. To expect an addict to give up her drug is like asking the average person to imagine living without all her social skills, support networks, emotional stability, and sense of physical and psychological comfort. Those are the qualities that, in their illusory and evanescent way, drugs give the addict. People like Serena and Celia and the others whose portraits have appeared in this book perceive their drugs as their rock and salvation. Thus, for all the valid reasons we have for wanting the addict to just say no, we first need to offer her something to which she can say yes. We must provide an island of relief. We have to demonstrate that esteem, acceptance, love, and humane interaction are realities in this world, contrary to what she, the addict, has learned all her life. It is impossible to create that island for people unless they can feel secure that their substance dependency will be satisfied as long as they need it. One of the greatest difficulties we human beings seem to have is to relinquish long-held ideas. Many of us are addicted to being right, even if facts do not support us. One fixed image we cling to, as iconic in today's culture as the devil was in previous ages, is that of the addict as an unsavory and shadowy character given to criminal activity. What we don't see is how we've contributed to making him a criminal. There is nothing more intrinsically criminal in the average drug user than in the average cigarette smoker or alcohol addict. The drugs they inject or inhale do not themselves induce criminal activity by their pharmacological effect, except perhaps in the way that alcohol can also fuel a person's pent-up aggression and remove the mental inhibitions that thwart violence. Stimulant drugs may have that effect on some users, but narcotics like heroin do not. On the contrary, they tend to calm people down. It is withdrawal from opiates that makes people physically ill, irritable, and more likely to act violently, mostly out of desperation to replenish their supply. The criminality associated with addiction follows directly from the need to raise money to purchase drugs at prices that are artificially inflated owing to their illegality. The addict shoplifts, steals, and robs because it's the only way she can obtain the funds to pay the dealer. History has demonstrated many times over that people will transgress laws and resist coercion when it comes to struggling for their basic needs, or what they perceive as such. Sam Sullivan, Vancouver's quadriplegic mayor, told a conference on drug addiction once that if wheelchairs were illegal, he would do anything to get one, no matter what laws he had to break. It was an apt comparison. The hardcore addict feels equally handicapped without his substances. As we have seen, many addicts who deal in drugs do so exclusively to finance their habit. There is no profit in it for them. As with petty drug pushing, so with prostitution. As this book is being completed, the disturbing details of the serial murder case against pig farmer Robert Picton are emerging in a British Columbia courtroom. If convicted, Picton will be counted among the most prolific and most sadistic killers of women in North American history. I believe that as a society, we are unwitting accomplices in the deaths of the downtown Eastside women who allegedly became Picton's victims because our criminalization of drug use drove those women into prostitution and into the underground street life that led to their deaths. if an evidence-based policy had been in operation in this country, these dozens of women, and their many counterparts elsewhere, might still be alive. Society would have much to gain.